The title is very long, but that's what happens when you've got a doctor and a lawyer trying to do work together. So this work was done with Dr. Tarun Jain, who's a reproductive endocrinologist at University of Illinois at Chicago, where I'm also an adjunct faculty at the School of Public Health. At DePaul, I run the Health Law Institute, and so issues of health disparities, racial inequality, are something very important to the Institute and has been a mission even long before I got involved. This work has been ongoing for both Dr. Jain and I separately for quite some time, and we were speaking at a conference together and realized that it would be important to merge these issues because the legal policy perspective is so important to the medical research data that he was finding. So what you're going to hear today is a conglomeration of the work we've both been doing. The learning objectives are self-identified. I have no disclosures to make for either one of us. And I want to begin by laying a bit of a legal foundation for you about procreative liberty. As with any right, this right is not absolute, but when the right does apply, it applies to all and should apply to all with some equality. There's a constitutional and Supreme Court lineage recognizing our procreative liberty. 1972, before the ever-famous Roe versus Wade, Eisenstadt versus Baird was decided by the Supreme Court. In that case, the court found that if a right to privacy means anything, and when we think about procreative liberty, it falls within that zone of privacy. It's the right of the individual, married or single, to be free from unwarranted governmental intrusion into matters so fundamentally affecting a person as the decision to bear or beget a child. Nothing in there discusses socioeconomic status, race, education, anybody, man, woman, married, single. This was reiterated 30 years later in Planned Parenthood versus Casey, where the Supreme Court there recognized protection accorded to liberty relating to intimate relationships, the family, and decisions about whether to bear and beget a child. So we do have a strong legal foundation for procreative liberty. But this causes us to then have to look at what the limitations might be. And one of those questions is, does this right extend to the ability to use ART to conceive? So assisted reproductive technologies. We might have a right to procreate, but do we have a right to these services? Now, the case of Lishay versus Hartigan, which is a Seventh Circuit case, it's the Northern District of Illinois, cited in 1990, alludes to the fact that maybe there is something there. The case said, it takes no great leap of logic to see that within the cluster of constitutionally protected choices that includes the right to have access to contraceptives, there must be included within that cluster the right to submit to a medical procedure that may bring about rather than prevent a pregnancy. So this case is leaning toward recognizing that maybe there is something to this right. This is probably the only language we've seen before or since that time, however. Legal scholar and bioethicist Dorothy Roberts, though, poses a question of whether this is really a matter of individual rights, or is it more a matter of social justice? She writes in her book, Killing the Black Body, Race, Reproduction, and the Meaning of Liberty, that reproductive freedom is a matter of social justice. Procreation's special status stems as much from its role in social structure and political relations as from its meaning to individuals. This language becomes very important for public health purposes, and we'll talk about that in just a moment. About 6.1 million women have impaired fertility. Leading factors, ovulation disorder, blocked fallopian tubes, PID, endometriosis, and congenital anomalies. I highlight these reasons because I want to point out that infertility really is a public health issue. Many of the factors leading to infertility are integral to women's health, pelvic inflammatory disease, STIs being a leading cause. These are things we all as public health professionals work on, but we also don't often think about that next level. We're thinking about prevention for the sake of the disease or the illness that's at issue, but not some of the longer-term impacts, such as the infertility. Okay, well, for some reason... there we go. Okay. This is to lay out for you some research that Dr. Jane, my colleague, did looking at infertility services in the United States, and you can see this steep upward climb with the number of ART cycles. So over here, it's pretty low and doubled in less than 10 years. So people are really accessing this. And the number of clinics has really skyrocketed as well. That number actually, the data is about 2 years delayed. So the most recent data we have is from 2005. And now there are over 132,000 ART cycles occurring, resulting in 50,000 live births annually. What's interesting about this information that's reported to the CDC, and it is required to be reported to the CDC by the 450-some-odd clinics that exist, even in the demographics that are reported, there's nothing in there about the race of any of the patients who are utilizing reproductive services. Age is considered, socioeconomic status, education, but there is nothing in there regarding race. And that becomes very important in this discussion. IVF is expensive. The mean cost in 2002 is about $9,547. It's probably a little higher now. The average report that I'm getting from fertility centers is about $12,500. The mean cost in 25 other countries, $3,518. Have to keep in mind, though, in many of those other countries, access is much more limited, different healthcare delivery systems as well. Look at that compared to the median U.S. household income of $43,381. Not really affordable for a lot of people to access ART. But considering the prevalence of infertility in the U.S., the number of treatment cycles, and the amount of money expended on and generated by this field, estimated to be about $4 billion annually, the lack of a national comprehensive regulatory scheme is striking. And we don't have any comprehensive national regulation like we do for adoption. So it's a big difference. This just is a breakdown of household income by race. So you can see that if we look at socioeconomic status, the inequalities in the ability to access ART services certainly is impacted here. Insurance, though. What about insurance? Currently, at least 15 states mandate coverage, or at least the offer of coverage for fertility services. I live in a state where there is an insurance mandate of 4 lifetime attempts at in vitro fertilization. But so many of the plans in our state are either self-funded or administered out of state, so they're not Illinois-based. So while we have this great Family Building Act, many people still can't access it. And what Dr. Jane has been looking at is whether mandated insurance coverage is associated with an increased utilization. And the answer is yes, to some extent, but that doesn't seem to eliminate the disparities. And just to break down the prevalence of infertility by race, you can see that there is some discrepancy with white population being sort of the least impacted. So this is significant when you look at this next slide about use of infertility services. The most recent comprehensive collection of this information addresses these issues from 1995 and was published in 2000. This study indicates that in that year, nearly 11,000 women were surveyed, and of those using infertility services, 70.1% were white. Some have argued, based on information like this, that the infertility problems of minorities have been ignored, which is certainly suggested by these numbers. Because of these figures and disparate income levels, infertility is very often, and the fact that infertility is often thought of as something that it is what it is. We'll have some later data. But it also is often thought of as a luxury service. Whenever you look at the cover of People magazine or USA Today and you see, or if you turn on your morning news show, like I did this morning, there was a story about infertility. Those who are portraying infertility are a very white middle class population. We very rarely see anybody but a highly educated upper middle class white couple accessing fertility services. Now, this is all despite the fact that we have been directed by Congress to annually track disparities in healthcare as they relate to racial and socioeconomic factors. And there have been disparities related to race, ethnicity, and SES that still pervade the American healthcare system, with disparities being observed in almost all aspects of healthcare, particularly reproductive endocrinology. From 2000 to 2006, many disparities for African and Americans and Hispanics are becoming larger. Why is such disparity in this particular area? Well, there have been very few studies, but some indicate that there are some physiological differences. One study of Asian women did find that they have a lesser success with in vitro fertilization. There was another study of African American women that found that they too have much less success, meaning a live birth rate with assisted reproductive technologies. Some factors in that study, the investigators found, could be things like an increased BMI and a longer period of time before getting to treatment. So suffering from infertility much longer, this goes very much to the heart of what we do in public health. So an African-American woman is more likely to be diagnosed with PID than endometriosis, even though the symptoms can be very similar. And upon further diagnosis, she may be found to actually suffer from endometriosis. It's hard enough to get a diagnosis, with the average diagnosis time being 5 years. But if you're African-American, that time period is even longer, which again, the older a woman becomes, even infertility services become more and more difficult. But there's also access issues, the financial issues we talked about, physical accessibility. Most fertility centers are not located in urban areas. They're located in suburban areas. They're hard to get to. There are cultural factors. Reproduction is something that differs among cultures. The discussion of infertility, especially if male infertility may be a factor, even though the woman's going to be treated, this can present enormous cultural barriers. And then in collaborative arrangements, such as egg and sperm donation, there may be a lack of donors, or at least a perceived lack of donors. There was a recently completed study in Illinois, where we have the mandate that I mentioned. It was done at University of Illinois Fertility Center, a self-administered questionnaire with about 1,300 women who presented for infertility care. And these are some of the numbers that show the duration of infertility. For Hispanic and African American, that number is greater. Education levels differ tremendously. Distance traveled to a fertility center. This was one of the few urban ones, so this defies my earlier point, except it's the only one that is located in that center. If we would have looked at the largest fertility center in the Chicagoland area, these numbers may have been reversed. And then insurance coverage. We see there's a lot of insurance, general coverage. Fertility coverage, again, is not great across populations, highest among Asian women. Some partial coverage and seeking reimbursement if they had to pay out of pocket. These numbers are interesting because 75% of low-income women in need of infertility services, a disproportionate number of them are African-American, and they don't have any access. Infertility is more prevalent among lower-income persons because of greater exposure to environmental toxins, sexually transmitted infections, and many of those who are lower-income suffer from poor nutrition and health care, making them, again, more likely to suffer from infertility, all factors we look at in public health. One legal scholar has gone so far as to say that this lack of access may in part be racially motivated. I'm not sure that I agree, but I think it's an important point to raise. What she said is that in a country which has historically controlled African-American reproduction through sterilization, abortion, and contraception, excluding infertility services from HMO contracts may be the latest means of ridding society of certain minority groups. Some pretty powerful language there. More data from Dr. Jane's research. Harder to get fertility treatment due to race or ethnicity. These numbers are very clear for African American and Hispanic women. Profession, also an issue. Income level, again, enormous. So socioeconomic status is maybe even more of a factor than race or ethnicity. as well as insurance status. Ability to bear children rests on, well, among populations it varies. Among Asians, God's will seems to be something that they don't necessarily agree with, but strongly agreed with in the African American population. And then a belief that it's the couple's physiology. In seeking fertility treatment, was this an important concern? Violating religious beliefs was a concern among some populations, not very important among others. Historical misuse of medical information, certainly more prevalent among minority populations, and an apprehension of technology, which ties into this historical misuse. Thank you. I found a quote in a women's magazine, an African-American women's magazine, and it said, "In the public imagination, women of African descent are supposed to be lush and fertile as the black soil of the motherland. Infertility is not our problem. That's for white women to deal with." So these cultural barriers exist not only from different cultures, but within a culture as well. And distrust also stems from part of this as well. The Tuskegee syphilis study still has an impact, especially when we're considering trusting advancing medical technology, not to mention discrimination in the 1970s regarding sickle cell carrier status, where black pilots were grounded or fired as flight attendants because they were carriers of the trait. They weren't affected by the disease itself. So this distrust exists, and it has its basis. But as I mentioned, race ties in with all of these numbers, with socioeconomic status as well as culture. Just want to touch briefly on the issue of lack of donors. Is this real or perceived? Well, according to one fertility center that I talked to, an egg donor recruiter, she actually told me anecdotally that she has more Hispanic and African American donors than she does recipients. But in some communities, you'll see that recipients assert that they don't have enough donors to choose from. A report from one sperm bank revealed that the inventory of donors is mostly Caucasian at 68%, with some Asian at 17%, some with mixed race, and a handful, about 4%, were African American. So whether this is real or perceived, we don't have the data here, so we don't know. It's really hard to tell, especially in egg donation where we don't have banks as we do in sperm donation. So how do we reduce this inequality? Well, one is increasing access. More insurance mandates. There are a number of bills currently on the agenda in a number of states that may be enacted this session. Public insurance benefits. Right now, Medicaid doesn't say no. It's just most fertility centers will reject patients who are on Medicaid. Location of clinics. Don't cluster them in the suburbs. Make them more accessible. Increase awareness. Media attention. If the media didn't focus so much on that upper middle class Anglo couple, there might be a more willingness to come forward to seek treatment. Program marketing. I've gone through and I've looked at the brochures, and there's always little chunky white baby feet on the cover of whatever their brochure might be. Bouncing white babies on all of the materials. Very rarely will you see any racial diversity in the materials that fertility centers are marketing with. Rebuild trust. That's a tough one, and we need to do it for all of medicine, not just reproductive endocrinology, but let's get past the misuse of information and utilizing medical information in a way that increases disparities at times rather than reducing them. More research and reporting is also essential. If we had more research and we could look more at these physiological factors that I mentioned earlier, which we're starting to see more and more of, that might go a long way as well. I want to conclude with a quote from Harold Shapiro, who's the former chair of Clinton's National Bioethics Advisory Commission. He said that one of our greatest responsibilities is to consider the full implications of our knowledge, not only for relieving human suffering and distress, but for the social and cultural institutions that are as critical as DNA to supporting our individual and collective lives. He recognized the enormous social responsibility in integrating technology into society. And while we've seen many amazing advances that have come and are likely to come from ART, it's going to continue to be imperative to recognize the potential harms and protect against them so society as a whole can benefit. Thank you.